The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha is considered to be the heart or the source of what Buddhism is. It comes out of his realization, his understanding, and his teaching. And down through the centuries until today, Buddhists will venerate the Buddha, will study his teachings, will hold him up in great esteem as being someone who's very important. I read recently of a scholar, famous scholar, who likened the Buddha to his contemporaries like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, approximately living at the same time, and equal to them in importance, one of the great philosophers of humankind. But he was more than a philosopher, he was also a religious leader, and who seemingly discovered amazing spiritual depths, spiritual heights, spiritual possibilities. And we find this one person a very interesting combination of great spiritual realization together with a great intellect, a great thinker, a philosopher. And so he was able to articulate not only his experience of freedom that he had, but more importantly, the path to it in a very precise, careful way that tended to avoid metaphysics, tended to avoid a lot of the supernatural, perhaps, a belief system that often is associated with religion. Because the Buddha was so important for Buddhism, as it's the case with many founders of major religions, over the centuries, a lot of different stories are, dare I say, invented about who this person was. And it's very clear that in the earliest record, the Buddha was a human being. And for the most part, the Theravada tradition, the school of Buddhism that we're aligned with here at IMC, continued to hold him as a human being. So, a human being who was different than everyone else in that he discovered something. He was the first to discover something. When I was growing up, my father told me that it was a big deal, I guess, in the 50s when he was paying attention. When someone finally was able to run the 4-minute mile, it said it couldn't be done. But then one person did it. Then after that, a lot of people did it. Somehow it broke a psychological barrier that people had that can't be done. And so once the Buddha became awakened or realized, he was able to transmit that to other people and show that, you know, he showed it was possible. And since that time, there have been a lot of people who have had the same experience as him. So he was unique. In the early tradition, he was considered unique because he was the first. And he was the first one then to show a possibility. Then down through the centuries, he got more and more aggrandized, mythologized. He became more and more treated almost like a god. In fact, in some schools of Buddhism, you'd have to say that the image, the idea they have of who the Buddha is really godlike. In the one famous Mahayana scripture, the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha that we relate to, is considered to be a magical projection, not a real person, but a magical projection of this amazing, eternal Buddha that lives someplace in some distant heaven, who's really in charge of the whole show. And because that was too big of a jump for us to understand or to believe that there is such an eternal cosmic Buddha, he did us a favor by projecting himself as a human being who was more or less ordinary. So he gave us kind of ordinary teaching, so we can kind of get on with it, get on with the program a little bit. And then several thousand years later, hundreds of years later, he revealed himself to a few individuals as being who he really was, which is this kind of cosmic kind of God. Pretty far out. There's sometimes some of the Mahayana scriptures of Buddhism have been described as phantasmagoric in the descriptions of the amazing descriptions of what a Buddha can be. And so there's been a lot of stories. But even in the Theravada tradition that we are in, the Buddha also sometimes, they keep saying he's human, but sometimes he's like, you know, just a little bit beyond. His abilities are such that it seems pretty far-fetched that any human being that we would know would ever have those. Now, one of the interesting things is that we see from this how the language of the stories and the ideas of who the Buddha is, how it changed over the centuries, is we see that every century, every society, every generation perhaps, creates a new story for who the Buddha is. And to some degree, as Buddhism has come to the West, the Western teachers, like myself, tell stories as well. We try not to make them up too much, but still, we tell all stories, and we kind of make them into more. We're kind of like, you know, we kind of, I don't know, embellish them the right way, but we say it in our language. Or just the fact that there's hundreds of stories about the Buddha to choose from, but the fact that we choose particular ones says maybe more about us who are doing the selecting than it does about the Buddha himself. Because if there's 100 stories to pick from, the Japanese might pick stories 25 to 35. The Koreans might pick 30. The stories 30 to 40. The Chinese might be, 45 to 55. The Tibetans might be, you get the idea? And so here in America, we might choose the second story and the 15th story, and then we might jump around to the 32nd, and because those are the ones that kind of are meaningful for who we are as a culture. So in this sense, the story of the Buddha has a pragmatic function. What's important is not the Buddha of history, but rather the Buddha of story. The Buddha that conveys some principles, some teachings, some inspiration, some reflection, some possibility that is meaningful for us, rather than who the Buddha was. So they say this is the Buddha of myth. And sometimes myth conveys teachings, understandings, meanings that are important for us much better than kind of conventional biographies. So if we go back in time, it's also possible, now if you look at all these stories that have been told down through the centuries of who the Buddha is, you see a steady progression of him getting more and more aggrandized. And you can almost watch it historically, century by century. So then you can go backwards in time and watch and become, if you start from the most recent stories of the Buddha and go backwards in time, you get more and more, earlier the records are, the more he seems like a human being. So you would think that you could go back, right down back to the time when he actually lived, and find the human being that was there. And there was in the late 1800s, there were Western scholars, especially English scholars, perhaps inspired by the 18th century studies of 19th century studies of Jesus, where they tried to separate out the historical Jesus from the myth, and so they tried to do the same thing, and with the Buddha, and what happened was they mostly saw themselves. there was some descriptions of the Buddha written in the 1890s in England, where he looks like a perfectly polite Victorian gentleman. and Now, one of the problems, so there are these old, old records. And if we go back to the records, the earliest records that exist, we find stories about who the Buddha was. And in fact, a lot of these stories are attributed to him directly. He's telling stories about himself. But he's not telling stories about himself because he's a reporter, because he's an kind of an uninterested, objective reporter of his own life. He's only telling stories of his life because those stories have the teaching function. And so he himself is selecting out of all the possible events of his life and choosing those events, those occurrences, which are useful for making the teaching point he wants to make at a particular time. And so he's already selecting something. So it's actually not possible to go back, you know, through the old records and get a sense, who was the Buddha really? Because even when we go back to the earliest ones, we get it already through the filter of his choices, his selection process that he made. And then how he chose to do it. And how he chose to make those his teaching points in relationship to what was going on around him. Even so, and also in these earliest records we have, you have at times where the Buddha seems very human. One of my favorite human stories of the Buddha is when he had a bad back. Isn't that nice? Some of us have bad backs, and we're in the company of the Buddha, you know, the Buddha too. And you know, usually the Buddha statues we have, like this one here, he's usually depicted as someone who's kind of not exactly prime of life, but maybe, you know, 36, 40 years old. You know, he's never wrinkled. And he's always sitting straight and upright. You know, his back is really straight. And you know, kind of radiant and serene and healthy and vibrant and all these wonderful things. The statues, generally, these statues themselves are pretty idealized. So it's nice to read a story where the Buddha had a bad back. And there was one evening he was teaching, and his back was bad enough that he had to lay down. So he said to Ananda, "Ananda, you carry on the teachings while I lay down." And then there's also a depiction, an account, where he describes himself as an old man, as being hunched over, bent over, and all wrinkled. And again, you look at these statues we have, and can't imagine this bent over old, you know, wizened, wrinkled kind of guy in his 80s. Usually we don't depict the founders of our religions that way. Because when we have a founder of our religion, he or she is supposed to be ideal. And so we depict it in ideal ways. Also, if you go back to the earliest records, it's not always so clear whether some of the stories about the Buddha are meant to be taken literally or meant to be taken figuratively as imaginative stories to make a point. And one of my favorite ones of this example of this is a story that was not told by the Buddha, but told by Ananda, who was the Buddha's kind of main attendant for many, many years. And and he's sitting around, and he says, "It's really wonderful. It's marvelous. It's miraculous. I heard this about the Buddha." And then he goes through these amazing stories about the Buddha. He's sitting around, and he's chatting with the other monks. And he says, "I heard this. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva," means the Buddha to be, before he became Buddha, in his last lifetime, "appeared in the Tusita heaven. That mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva appeared in Tusita heaven. This I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One." I heard that he stayed in that Tusita heaven before he was born as a human. I heard that from that Tusita heaven, he descended into his mother's womb. I heard that when the Bodhisattva passed away from Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins. And even in the abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. No, this is an ordinary human being. He's going to, you know, he gets conceived. He descends from heaven into his mother's womb and this amazing light. That's a nice story. And the beings born there perceived each other by that light. And I heard that when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters so no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasure, from false speech, from wines, liqueurs, and intoxicants. I heard that when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no sensual thoughts arose in her concerning men. And she was inaccessible to any man having a lustful mind. So imagine the monks are going around talking, you know, Nanda's telling stories, right? So is this to be taken seriously? Is this literally true? Is he saying a true story? Or is this somehow, is he telling yarns? Is he making it up to make some other kind of point? It goes on and on. I could, you know, he's just drumming it in, all these stories, kind of building up the tension, the climax, building kind of this amazing story of this kind of godlike being. I heard that other women give birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him standing up. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first gods received him, then human beings. That's nice. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. The four young gods received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O queen, a son of great power has been born to you." It's nice. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water or humors or blood or any kind of impurity. Okay. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. It's convenient. And then I heard, as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took seven steps facing north, and with a white parasol held over him, he surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. "I am the highest in the world, I am the best in the world, I am the foremost in the world, this is my last birth, now there is no renewal of being for me." That's a, you know, precocious kid. I haven't seen that in a newborn. So each time it tells these stories, it says, it has a refrain, and the refrain is, "This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One." So I can go on with these kinds of stories. But remember, each one's refrain, "This too is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha." So, you know, you imagine, I kind of imagine the monks are sitting around, they're getting kind of excited, they love hearing these stories. It's just, you know, Are they being wowed because they really believe it? Or is this kind of for some other purpose to telling these stories? It goes on and on, and then comes the climax. So now, so the Buddha hears that Ananda says all this. So Ananda's saying all this, the Buddha's kind of there, and the Buddha says, oh, okay. And the Buddha says, that being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata, the Buddha. Okay, so here the Buddha is going to say, this is what you should really remember as a marvelous and special quality of the Buddha. Here, for the Buddha, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha. What do you think of that? After all that kind of miracle stories, the Buddha himself, when he speaks, has a chance to finally speak for himself, he says, when there's feelings, I know there's feelings. When there's perceptions, I know there's perceptions. And when there's... what's so special about that? I mean, that seems like pretty uninteresting thing, right? I think what's happening here is that there's a setup, a literary setup, where all these miracle stories are setting us up to get our attention and really say, to really kind of wake up when we hear, oh, to really see our feelings when the feelings are occurring, see when they exist, see when they pass away, to really see perception when it occurs and when it passes away. There's something very, very profound about that. Perhaps more profound than all these miracle stories that are presented here. It's like the Zen story where they say, you know, someone does all these miracles and the Zen master says, oh, the real miracle is chopping water and carrying wood. You know, the ordinary activities of life. So, in terms of the story of the Buddha, are we to take all these miracle stories as being literally true? Or were they just kind of made up for literal purposes, pedagogical purposes, to make a point? So if I imagine the monks were just sitting around, having a time of their life, making up all these wild stories they could make up. You know, probably a whole bunch of them were kind of trying to outdo the other one. And they're probably laughing when this is being said. And of course they didn't take it as being true. And they're just making it all up. And then they kind of came in with a punchline at the end. And, you know, that's what, you know, I don't, who knows? But why I went on with this is that over time, the idea that this might have been a literary creation was forgotten. And Buddhists tended started to see this as being real. Was it real? Did the Buddha have all these miracle kind of events in his life? People of faith, certain kinds of faith, hold that this has actually happened. And there are Buddhists who believe this literally. And then there are Buddhists who think, oh, this is much, you know, this is somehow later. It's a later invention, probably written a few hundred years after the Buddha. And maybe they believed it then, but it couldn't have represented the Buddha himself. Or was it just kind of a fun story, pedagogical story, teaching story, that was made up at the time of the Buddha? We don't know. This is a pretty dramatic story here. There's events and stories in the earliest literature which is not so black and white. So what I'd like to do in the remaining time, I would like to tell you the life of the Buddha in a kind of common mythic way that it's presented here in the West. I could embellish it a lot more, but I'm just going to do kind of the basic kind of myth, the way that you might hear it. And then next week, I would like to try to reconstruct the best we can who the person, what his life actually was like, freed of the myth, knowing that we can't really do it completely. It's not possible, because as I said before, the Buddha himself was selecting how he talked about himself. So you can't really get back to the original person. But still, we can kind of separate out a mythic layer from a less mythic layer, and that's what I'll try to do. So, four incalculable eons ago, and a kalpa is a long time. A kalpa is how long it takes. If you have a granite block, it's one square mile cubic square. And a celestial maiden comes by once every 100 years and brushes that 1 square mile cube, one cubic, with her scarf. A kalpa is how long it takes for that cube to wear down to dust. So that's a long time. So four incalculable of these. So this is an immense amount of time, you know. Immense amount of time ago, there was an ascetic, a religious renunciant by the name of Sumedha. And he was up in the mountains practicing asceticism, wearing bark cloth, and he was really interested in the spiritual path. And he heard someone say that there was a Buddha that had come into being in his area. And that Buddha was going to be coming to town soon. So he came down from the mountains, and in order to, because he was so excited, he wanted to meet the Buddha. He came down out of the mountains into town and waiting for the Buddha. And as he saw the Buddha walking along, he was deeply inspired. And he thought to himself, I too would like to be a Buddha. And as he saw the Buddha come closer, he had nothing to offer the Buddha because he was an ascetic, he had nothing. But he saw on the ground, there was mud from the recent rains, a little puddle. So he laid himself down on the path, and he had this long kind of hair, and he threw his hair down onto the puddle so the Buddha wouldn't get wet as he walked across down the path. So that Buddha, his name, that Buddha back then, four incalculable kalpas ago, his name was Dipankara, which means the light maker, maker of light. Dipankara Buddha. He stopped and saw that this ascetic was, you know, had laid himself down on the path in front of him. And he kind of gave him a prediction. He said, you, in some future time, will become a Buddha. So that's what we know from that life. And then in these four incalculable kalpas of time, this person who started off as Sumedha, this ascetic, was reborn many, many times. And because he had set himself on the course of becoming a Buddha, he then undertook the training to become a Buddha. And that training was a training of the Bodhisattva. And he was cultivating and developing 10 spiritual qualities within him, trying to perfect them. Because when he needed to have these 10 qualities perfected to have the inner strength to become a Buddha. And those qualities were generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. So he spent endless lifetimes cultivating these qualities. And sometimes he sacrificed his life for this famous story of the hungry tigress. She couldn't feed her own kids anymore because she had no food and she was starving. So the Bodhisattva laid himself down in front of her so she could eat him. so she could then feed her cubs. And he was just kind of practicing renunciation, generosity, practicing all these things. There's lots of stories. And there's collections of these stories called Jataka tales that recount, it's kind of like Aesop tales, many of them, that recount these stories of when he was, these lifetimes before he became the Buddha. Then, in the last lifetime, before he was going to become born as Siddhartha, he was, as the book said, to Sita heaven, this very special heavenly realm, getting ready. And his mother had a dream, and the dream was of a six-tusked white elephant entering into her side. And that was how she conceived. And he descended into the womb that way. So I don't know if that's Immaculate Conception or how it is, but... And then in the way they counted in the old days, after 10 months, he was born. But he was born standing. You know, the mother was standing, and he came out, and he took these seven steps, and he said, "I'm the greatest one." And then there came a sage from far away, came to see that baby, a wise man. And that wise man looked at this baby and said, "Oh, this baby will grow up and have one of two destinies. Will either become a great world-conquering monarch or will become a great monarch of the Dharma, a great spiritual leader." The father, hearing this, as sometimes fathers are, said, "Well, you know, this is not so good, because he's supposed to go into the family business. And this spiritual thing, you know, that doesn't work. So I have to make sure that he doesn't go into the spiritual line of work, but stays and, you know, runs, you know, the kingdom when I becomes the king." Because his father was a king. And so his father then built these palaces, one for each season, and raised the Buddha in these different palaces, protected from the harsh realities of life. So as the Buddha grew up, he saw no one who was sick, he saw no one who was old, and he saw no one who was dying. So very protected. And then he had a wonderful education, all kinds. At some point he was married. At some point they had a kid. And at some point, soon after, around the time his son was born, he asked his charioteer to take him into town. Kind of jumped over the walls that his father had created. And for the first time, apparently, he went into town and he saw what he hadn't seen before. He saw a sick person. And he asked the charioteer, "What's that?" And the charioteer said, "That's a sick person. It's the nature of all people to become sick at some point." And so he was kind of shocked. Then they saw an old person. And the Siddhartha said, "What's that? That's an old person. It's the nature of all people to live long enough to become old." And he was shocked. And then they saw a corpse. "What's that? It's a dead person. It's the nature of all people to die at some point." And Siddhartha was shocked. Now, there are people who grow up. I was going to say that I didn't see a corpse until I was well into my 20s. Actually, there was one exception. That was when I was 11 years old. I was in Nepal. And I saw them carrying a cloth-wrapped corpse of a child to go down to the river in Kathmandu to get for the pyre to be cremated. But it's possible, you know, to grow up and not see death. It's possible to grow up and not see old people too much, because we tend to put them away in places. And it's possible to not really grapple or really see in some realistic way the nature of what it is to be a human being. So in any case, then the Buddha was still with his charioteer, and they saw a renunciant, a spiritual seeker. And this spiritual renunciant was walking through the city with great calm, very composed, calm, settled, peaceful. And so the Buddha said, "What's that?" "That's renunciant, person on a spiritual path." And the Buddha was so inspired by that, said, "Oh, someone who's found how to find peace in this world that has sickness, old age, and death." So with that, he decided that that's what he was going to do with his life, that he had to find some kind of peace, some kind of resolution, some kind of solution, some kind of understanding, some kind of truth in relationship to this fundamental existential issues that he had suddenly confronted in his life. So he then cut off his hair. He had long, beautiful hair, they said, became a renunciant. I think he was about 29 years old, they say, and entered into the renunciant life of India of his time. And he spent 6 years being an ascetic. There was a strong tradition of asceticism in the spiritual circles of his time, and with the idea that if you could just starve yourself, you somehow liberate the soul. You liberate, if you kind of take the material body and starve it and emaciate it and everything, then you can liberate and free some inner essence and become free. And it's said that the Buddha became outstanding at being an ascetic. He was the most ascetic of the ascetics. And he did it so far that he would collapse on the road, and people would walk by and say, "Oh, there's a corpse there." But he would get up and manage to stumble along. And then one day he stumbled and fell into a river. And he said, you know, "If I do this anymore, I'll die. And I still wouldn't have resolved these issues that I'm trying to deal with. I still wouldn't have become free. So this is not working. So what I'll do is I'll eat a little bit to regain my strength." So he did. And then he sat and reflected. And he remembered a time when he was 6 years old, and how in a beautiful spring day, sitting quietly alone under a rose apple tree, he spontaneously, on his own, fell into a deep state of meditative absorption that was filled with joy. And it was quite a contrast from all the ascetic pain that he had for 6 years, and this memory of feeling very peaceful and happy in this kind of spontaneous 6-year-old kind of absorption that he was in. And he reflected on that absorption he had as a 6-year-old and said, you know, there was no blame in that joy. Because back then, they were concerned that sensual pleasure, joy that came from sensual pleasure, was kind of not really so pure. But this joy that he felt from absorption didn't come from sensual pleasure. So the Buddha said it was blameless. It's okay. And what if I experiment with that as a route to freedom? So then he sat down and re-entered that absorption that he had when he was a 6-year-old. Re-experienced that joy and happiness. That joy and happiness, he emphasized how very different it was from those spiritual traditions of his time that stressed the importance of suffering, of pain. And from this vantage point of the deep sense of well-being and peace these meditative absorptions gave him, he was then able to see something that apparently no one else had seen up to that time. And he was able to see, and that to be a shorthand because it's 9 o'clock, he was able to see that the source of his suffering, the source of what created him as a human being and what created his experiences as a human being. And he saw that the source had to do with what he did with his own mind. So rather than attributing his situation, his pain, his suffering, his happiness to things outside of him, he saw that the responsibility for his happiness and his suffering resided in his own mind. And that his continual involvement in a life of suffering was perpetuated by something he was doing in his own mind. And as he looked more carefully, he saw what that was. And he saw that it had to do with clinging. And so if there was clinging in there, that gave birth to further suffering. More important than that is that he saw that, and then he was able to let go of that clinging. Let go of all this clinging. And as he let go of that clinging, he became free. Then he started going around teaching. And he taught for 40, 45 years. And wandering around India, teaching anybody who came his way. And he created a monastic order. First a monastic order of monks, and then a monastic order of nuns. He seemed to have been very interested in the training of his monastics, so they would learn his teaching so they could pass it on to others. And then when he was 80, 81 years old, he describes himself as being quite weak, fragile, held together. He said, "I'm held together like an old rickety cart held together by lots of rope. And the only way I can really manage without being in a lot of pain is by dropping into this my deep meditative absorption. That's the only relief that I get at this point in my old age." And he was heading home, apparently. From the record, it seems like he was going back to where he was born. But he didn't make it. And in a small place, he lay down beneath two sal trees, majestic trees they have in India, and prepared himself to die. Before he did, he died, he wanted to make sure that his monks, nuns, didn't have any more questions. And he asked them, and no one had any questions. He was satisfied they knew what he had to teach them. They were prepared for his going. Near the end of the time, he went to emphasize what he learned, and he said, "This is what I discovered." And this is kind of quite significant. In the last days of his life, you know, he knows he's dying. He says, "This." He's going to say, "This is what I discovered." You can imagine everyone leans forward then. And he says, what he doesn't say is truths. He doesn't say creeds. What he says he discovered are qualities of heart and mind that lead to liberation. He discovered mindfulness. He discovered the investigation. He discovered energy. He discovered joy. He discovered tranquility. He discovered concentration. And he discovered equanimity. And how those seven factors can be onward leading to help the mind let go in this very deep way that lets someone become liberated. I think it's quite phenomenal that as he's going to die, he says, "This is what I discovered." And he lists inner qualities that we could all cultivate, not truths that you have to believe. And then at some point he laid down between those two salt trees, and laying on one side, he entered into his deep meditation. And it said that he went all the way through the deepest kind of meditation you can experience. And there in the deepest meditation, his attendant Ananda said, "Oh, the Buddha has passed away." And one of the other senior disciples who had a higher attainment in meditation and realization than Ananda said, "Nope, not quite." And then the Buddha descended almost back to normal consciousness. So he kind of went through one, you know, grand tour of the different states of meditation that he wasn't familiar with. And then in the fourth jhana, from that fourth jhana, deep state of absorption, deep state of equanimity and peace, he let go. And conventionally we say he died. Then people ask, what happened to him as a Buddha? Did he get reborn? Did he just disappear? That's it? What happens to a Buddha when a Buddha dies? He was asked that when he was still alive, and that was one of the questions he said is not interesting to ask. It cannot be answered. It's not possible to say that a Buddha who dies continues after death. It's not possible to say the Buddha does not continue. And any variation of those two is not possible to say. That's not something you talk about. They're just... So what we see in some of the legends of the Buddha, there's lots more legends I could have shared with you, is you see a juxtaposition of miracle stories, miraculous stories of an individual with something that's quite ordinary, but something that's accessible for all of us as human beings. When he talked about what he discovered at the end, he didn't talk about all the miracles, all the grandeur of his birth and many lifetimes and as a bodhisattva. He talked about cultivating mindfulness, and investigation, and energy, and joy, tranquility, equanimity, concentration, something all of us can do. When he, in the night of his enlightenment, before he became enlightened, he had a grand vision memories of past lifetimes. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lifetimes he remembered. Quite phenomenal. But when he really gets down to the critical moment of his enlightenment, it wasn't all the past lifetimes that was important, but it was something that is ordinary enough that it's accessible to all of us. That is, he understood something about the nature of clinging and the possibility of letting go of clinging. So this juxtaposition of myth and a myth that points us back to ourselves, hopefully, to something that we can do without becoming a myth ourselves as ordinary people. So that is what is for tonight. And then next week I'll try to do away with all those myths and a lot more myths. Like, for example, it was only until many, many hundreds of years after the Buddha lived that the tradition started to call him Siddhartha. Isn't that interesting? Well, we have no evidence, you know, that he was really called that, except 500-600 years later. So once scholars get in there and start to pull apart things, apart the myth, a lot of things we know about the Buddha falls away as being myth. But then if you go back to the very earliest literature, you still have some picture of who that person was. And that's a task of next week. Okay? So thank you.